Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, Massimo, today we have a special guest with us in our studio. Jesse Prince is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York Graduate Center.
Oh, that's where I heard about him. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Sound familiar? Yeah. Jesse works primarily in the philosophy of psychology, and in just generally speaking how the mind works. And he has published a bunch of popular books, most recently a book called Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape Our Lives, which is one of the things we're going to focus on in our discussion today. Jesse, welcome. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here, Julia. Thanks very much.
To start out, maybe you could just summarize for our listeners what the thesis of your new book is.
Well, the book really began because of a spate of books that were coming out telling a very biological story about the human mind. Mm-hmm. So people were being told that human behavior is largely a result of evolved processes, that men are biologically different from women, and that affects the way we think. And it really struck me that this was only half of the human story, that the human story begins where biology lets off. And if there's anything that's really striking about us, it's that we're so diverse. You walk into a crowded lunchroom and everybody's dressed differently. Everybody has a different hairstyle. Everybody has different tastes and interests, even different thought patterns. And there's a very exciting new discipline called cultural psychology, which investigates these variations in human thought. And I think that is a branch of science that the general public really needs to know about. It's the science of human difference.
So, Jesse, you said a number of books. Let's name names. So, for instance, I don't know, Steven Pinker?
We don't pull any punches here.
Well, Pinker is an interesting case because I think he was someone who appeared to me as a foil when he wrote How the Mind Works. Was a kind of compendium to the mind, almost a user's guide. He had a list of chapters on right. different aspects of psychology, each of which then went on to tell a very evolutionary story. And I began the project really thinking it would be a response to that, with chapters on different aspects of the mind, but this time mm-hmm. telling the cultural story. But Pinker is a very careful, I think, thinker, and he's somebody who's tried to give a balanced view. And in fact, his most recent book is on cultural differences in violence, which right. does suggest that our cultural situation can affect our behavior in profound and really very important ways. So there are worse offenders out there. Someone like David Buss, for instance, who's an evolutionary psychologist in Texas, right. who's very interested in gender differences. And I think a lot of his work has been pernicious insofar as it has reified, it's naturalized differences between the sexes that have a cultural origin. And by describing them as natural, he's given them the legitimacy that they shouldn't have.
Mm. Can you give any specific examples of aspects of like human behavior or human psychology that you think deserve more of a cultural explanation, but some of these other people explain evolutionarily?
Well, gender is a good starting place. So we're told that men really like to have multiple partners and women really like to be monogamous. We're told that men are vastly more violent than women. We're told that men are more assertive. We're even told that men have more systematic or, one might say, intellectual thinking styles, where women are more emotional, more driven by empathy, more prone to hysteria, to take a very...
Take that back! I'm sorry.
So, you know, these are old and familiar cliches, and I think what the modern evolutionary approaches have done is they've tried to weave a narrative that makes sense of those differences biologically. And the narrative is so seductive that people say, well, maybe these things are based in biology, not in culture. And of course, if you go out and do the science and try and look for these gender differences, you often will find them. But what you don't look for in just describing how men and women think is the origin of those differences. And the biological explanations are often much less satisfying than the cultural explanations. And when we start thinking...
Less satisfying, just
well,
like... epistemically, like
false.
We really don't pull punches here.
So, I mean, if you take something like a male and female difference in jealousy, this is hugely varied cross culturally. It's been claimed that men are more sexually jealous and women are more emotionally jealous. So, guys don't like when their partner, their female partner, is sleeping around, and women don't like when their male partner has fallen in love with someone else. But, you know, in fact, there's a really straightforward cultural explanation for this, which is that women have depended on men economically and have had to put up with a lot of infidelity. And as long as the guy is willing to kind of come home and continue to provide material support, they're willing to put up with this. And the old double standard of allowing male infidelity, I think, is really woven into our preference system because of those financial dependencies. So to test this, what you want to do is look cross-culturally and say whether these differences hold up everywhere. And they don't. So,
is there any pattern to which cultures they don't hold in, or which social system they don't?
The patterns are as rich and as interesting as culture itself. So, for instance, they don't hold up in China, and they don't hold up in the Netherlands. These are really different cultures. And so, China tends to be very sexually closed, so men and women have the same attitude towards jealousy, which tends to focus on emotional jealousy, because sexuality outside of the marriage context is fairly taboo and not widely talked about, at least until recently. In the Netherlands is sort of the opposite. Sexuality is considered a very casual relationship, and therefore people aren't as threatened by sexual infidelity. So both men and women think emotional infidelity is worse in the Netherlands. They don't show this gendered difference in jealousy.
But in China, it sounded, from the way you described it, like sexual jealousy isn't a problem just because there isn't infidelity, but I would have hoped that the question would be more like, if like your mate were to have a sexual dalliance with someone else, would that upset you if there was no emotion involved?
There are other factors too. I mean, I think in China and other cultures, there may be long traditions of arranged marriage. There might be ways in which romantic relationships are really a family affair. Your parents' preferences, your uncles and aunts may weigh into the marriage decision. Mm-hmm. So a breakdown in a marital relationship is a bit more like a business failure. Two families have been brought together with a tremendous amount of pressure. So it may be a combination of factors. Sexuality may just be less talked about. Sexuality outside of marriage may be less common, but also it may be of more marginal importance with respect to the basic underlying structure of a marriage there.
Mm-hmm. So, but just to be clear, and particularly because you mentioned Pinker and how he's not only careful in what he writes, but also as his latest book seemed to some people in somewhat in contradiction, actually, with some of the stuff that he was writing earlier on, when he took a little more strong evolutionary psychological approach to things. But in fact, there doesn't have to be a contradiction, right? I mean, you're not saying that biology doesn't matter. You're just saying that it matters in a different way from say, a naive evolutionary psychological approach would imply.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I didn't write Beyond Human Nature to criticize biology. It's not called Against Human Nature. And I think there are ways in which the very idea of human nature might be problematic because of cultural variation. But that doesn't mean we don't have a certain biology that allows us to be the kinds of creatures we are. If you try and raise a chimpanzee in a human society, they're not going to end up with the behaviors that we do. So there's something about our biology that allows us to be the way we are. And I think even if you take the most extreme claims that are made among the biological determinists, so take something like personality traits and listen to a biological story about how 50% of our personality is just woven into the genes. Well, that's really interesting. And even if we accept it on the face of that claim, I think it still raises this other question, which is, wow, what about the other 50%? Right. And the idea that identical twins might end up with really different personality traits is, I think, fascinating. So we don't need to deny the biological story to take interest in what social factors might make a contribution to how we
right.
are.
Right. So one of the reviewers of your book, Sam Blackburn, who is obviously a very prominent philosopher in England, studied out his review by pointing out that the problem with too strong of a biological story about humanity is that it doesn't take into account what he didn't use this term, but what biologists call gene environment interactions. And that turns out to be actually my field before I moved to philosophy. And it always struck me as, even though I was working on plants and not on animals, but it always struck me as somewhat strange to make the case that, oh, well, this trait has, 50% heritability or whatever it is, which, by the way, it's not very high, as it turns out. But it struck me as bizarre because, for one thing, for what you just said, that is, yeah, okay, so what about the remaining 50%? That's not an afterthought. That's actually a fairly large chunk of variation there. But also because many people don't seem to appreciate very basic facts about population genetics, for instance, that irritability as a measure of a statistical association between phenotypes and genotypes itself is environmentally variable. So one of the experiments that we were doing when I had a lab at Stony Brook University, for instance, was to put exactly the same genotypes under, you know, set of genotypes under very different conditions, and then we would measure the irritability of certain traits. And it turns out that if you measure the irritability of, say, I don't know, flowering time, for instance, in one environment, it was, I don't know, 80%. I'm just coming up with numbers out of nowhere here, but they're reasonable numbers. And then you measure the same irritability, the same trait in a different environment, they may drop to almost zero. And that's because there's this complex interaction between genes and environment. So what you see as the final result, as the phenotype, the behavior of the organism, is this completely interwoven thing where you cannot simply separate, not even in principle, separate and say, well, that's the genes and that's the environment. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. And I think what listeners need to appreciate is that heritability is just the measure of variation in a population that correlates with some biological factor. And you can have cases of heritability that are very high simply because the environment is extremely uniform. If two creatures are in the exact same environment, then any variation left will be due to the genes. But you can't even go to that gene language with heritability, because when you say correlated with something biological, there may be these interesting biocultural interactions. So a classic example of this would be wearing two earrings. So wearing symmetric earrings turns out to be highly correlated with being female in our society. So it turns
because there's a genes for the number of earrings.
So
obviously,
we can't conclude there's a gene for it, even though it works out to be heritable. But I think the point you make is of very strong social significance, because we end up getting fed a lot of numbers, and the numbers include things like intelligence is highly heritable, maybe a 0.6, 0.5 heritability for IQ, and we start to think, okay, this is biologically determined. But in fact, those numbers depend on keeping environment healthy and uniform. And as soon as your environments start to get more varied, or as soon as they become less healthy, those numbers tail off. So if you look at heritability of intelligence in low socioeconomic status settings, that is, people who are poor, heritability is negligible. And that's because if you grow up poor, your environment is really unstable, and whether you end up performing well scholastically, which is what IQ measures, will depend on totally random factors, like whether you had a very inspiring teacher, whether you had a parent who happened to have enough free time to help you out with your homework, whether you happened to be situated near a public library or somewhere else where you could get inspired by learning. So I do think we are in danger of taking heritability numbers as a kind of stand-in or synonym for genetic coding.
I'd like to zoom out a bit for a bit to the epistemology here in distinguishing between nature and nurture explanations. So I was thinking about your example of sexual versus emotional jealousy and how it's not universal. And it occurred to me that I don't know what I would expect to see if it were mostly nurture versus mostly nature. Like, let's say it were the case that like 85 or 90% of cultures demonstrated more sexual jealousy among men and more emotional jealousy among women, but then 10% of cultures demonstrated the reverse, or like an equal amount of sexual and emotional jealousy between genders. Is that, like, I would assume that the people who argue that it's nature would not claim that would result in a 100% adherence to that pattern, that surely they would still expect that in some cases there could be weird cultures that override natural impulses. And so is that, like, is 90% conforming to the pattern in support of the nature explanation, or is it in support of the nurture explanation? I don't really know how to evaluate that evidence.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think it's a question that all parties on both sides of this debate should be answering, because there's a tendency to think that any sort of statistic on the frequency of a trait is somehow a measure of how natural it is. But in fact, what you might be getting with highly frequent traits is just a historical fact, a fact that most human societies until recently have had similar structure. So take something like male dominance. Mm-hmm. Say, male dominance is really pervasive. I mean, just about every culture on record has had men in some way dominating over women. See, why is this true? Well, it could be just part of our biology, or it could be connected to our biology in a more indirect way. So for instance, if you take male upper body strength as a biological difference between men and women, and you imagine a social setting where that strength makes a difference to, say, how much food you can produce for the group, how many calories you can bring in for the group, men are going to be in a huge position of advantage because they're going to become the primary breadwinners. And that's exactly what you see when you make the transition from hunter-gatherer societies, where when men and women basically bring in equal portions of the food consumed, to agricultural societies, where men start to do a disproportionate amount of the work. And I think it's really in those settings that the dominance patterns appear, and it's in those settings that all of these familiar gender differences start to appear. So men start to treat women as property, women start to depend on men economically, and all these differences in jealousy and sexual patterns start to appear. Women will marry men who are much older than them, because men, as the primary breadwinners, acquire more goods as they get older. Women will tend to go for wealthier men. Wealthier men will tend to be polygamous. Most human societies are polygamous. And, you know, that's a really striking fact. If we were just doing the statistics, we would say, oh, well, human beings are naturally polygamous. But this just isn't so. Agriculture is a human invention, and I think when you see a widespread pattern across human societies, it may just reflect the fact that human societies have converged historically on certain kinds of resources. When you start to see that changing, so let's go to your 10%, through new technologies, through a change in economic structure, like the move of women onto the workforce after the Second World War in Western societies, suddenly these differences start to change. And I think we're right now in a time of transition where we're not seeing a move away from human nature. We're seeing the plasticity of human nature. We're seeing that human nature can manifest itself in very, very different ways, depending on the kind of societies in which we live.
But what about the evolutionary argument for why we would expect sexual jealousy to be more predominant in men, emotional in women? Like, it at least seems to make sense on the face of it that, men want to make sure that their child is actually theirs. So any sexual dalliance is not okay, regardless of any emotional or non-emotional status of that attachment.
Basically, the evolutionary model assumes pair bonding. It assumes these kind of nuclear families where two people, a man and a woman, are raising their children. And therefore, if a man is investing in a child who isn't genetically related, he's wasting his biological resources, and genes should sort of program men to avoid doing this. And it's a very seductive story.
Yeah.
The problem is the first premise. The nuclear family is a fairly modern invention. Hmm. Historically, children have been raised by whole communities, the kind of it takes a village idea.
Which is the same that happens actually in closely related species to humans. It's, you know, there's no nuclear family among bonobos, for instance.
So males would not have any particular incentive to make sure that the women that they sleep with are sleeping with fewer men?
I think the other thing we need to remember is that in a small scale society, there will be some genetic variation because there will be some contact with neighboring groups, but far less than we're talking about now. So when we're looking at the evolutionary context and we imagine small bands of hunter gatherers existing, in the savanna where they're really rarely coming into contact with distantly related others, taking care of of the kids in your group, whether they're your own directly or merely effectively nieces and nephews, probably closer in genetic relatedness to our nieces and nephews, is not such a bad evolutionary prospect. So I think a collective rearing like you see in bonobos or common chimps is a very viable biological strategy. And if we look across species, across primate species alone, every possible variation can be seen. So I think the evolutionary argument that says that only if you have care for your direct biological offspring is just refuted by the presence of species where that pattern is never observed, including the closest related species to human beings.
But then why does pair bonding happen? Like, what would be the point of that if not to help ensure the success of the child?
Well, you can think about every society is facing a problem of regulating human behavior. And I think with respect to human behavioral regulation, certain domains tend to be of particularly strong importance. So violent behavior is strongly regulated. So we have laws and moral systems evolved to keep us from killing each other. But the other thing that's strongly regulated is sex, because you have a danger of having social instability if there isn't some regularity and some rules about who can sleep with whom. And that is a solution that every society has come to. We need some rules, but the range of rules is as open-ended as sexual practice itself.
But I thought pair bonding was innate, that there was a biological... Massimo, back me up here. No?
No. No.
What? I thought we talked about this in the love episode, like way, way back when.
Yes, but again, I think the point that Jesse just made
was... Not
permanent
pair bonding.
That's right. First of all, pair bonding is not...
But for several years, the length of time that you would need to invest in a child.
But even that is pretty recent in evolutionary history. Yeah, it's really a cultural history that not as much... It doesn't go into deep evolutionary time as far as the human species is concerned. Again, that doesn't mean that there aren't certain biological characteristics about human sexual behavior that one needs to take into account in order to make sense of human sexual behavior. But I think that the issue that Jesse brought up, that many people seem to sort of forget, that there's been this thing like agricultural revolution, which is clearly too recent to have affected dramatically human evolution at a genetic level, but it has affected dramatically the structure and functioning of our society, and also the group size issue that Jesse brought up. We live in much larger, much more varied societies. We have done so for thousands of years now, but it wasn't that was not the case for most of human history. So if we're talking about what evolutionary biologists call the evolutionary relevant environment, you know, the Pleistocene, whatever it is. I don't know, by the way, why everything happened in the Pleistocene. You know,
or the savannah.
Or the savannah.
Like, why is it always the savannah?
Why
I don't
is it always
know.
The savannah? What about the trees? But anyway, you know, for most of our human evolution, we were not in that kind of situation. And so there is those issues, I think, are relevant. But I want actually to move to a... An example that I thought I was going to bring up before reading more about your book in your favor, and it turns out actually you disagree. So let me put it this way.
All right,
so I was going to talk about language, and I always bring up the idea when these discussions about the relative contribution of biology and culture come in. You know, the standard example is, well, look, consider human language. We have a natural ability to learn languages. That's the biology. But that doesn't tell you anything at all about which language you're going to talk, you're going to be able to speak, because that depends entirely on your culture. You know, if you end up growing up in China or in the 21st century or in England in, you know, 16th, it's a completely different thing. But as it turns out, you don't actually seem to buy the Chomskyan idea that there is something fundamental about the grammar structure of the brain. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think when Chomsky came on the scene, psychology was dominated by behaviorists, by people who thought that all human learning was driven by a simple associative learning rule. We get conditioned to behave the way that we do. And that was clearly an oversimplification. If you had nothing but associative learning going on in human beings, then any other creature that could learn associatively should learn what we learn. But that wasn't the case. So I think Chomsky was a very important figure in the history of cognitive science, because he started to argue that there must be specialized learning mechanisms that distinguish the human outcome from other creatures. And I think he's right that there must be some difference in how we learn and how other creatures learn. And a lot of the debate just centers on the nature of that difference.
Okay.
So Chomsky thinks what's special about us is something specific to language. He compares language to an organ. He thinks there's a specialized system in the brain that's there for the purpose of acquiring language. And in the 1950s already, he had a series of arguments for this that were then developed in the 60s and 70s that struck a lot of people as extremely powerful. But they were arguments that were really created from the armchair without a single bit of evidence. Chomsky never collected data, and some of his followers have. But as we do that more and more, the arguments have fallen away. And the arguments tend to have a form that says, here's a certain thing that kids couldn't possibly learn based on the evidence they're exposed to.
Or the poverty of stimulus arguments.
Mm-hmm. Or here's an error that kids never make, but they should make if they were learning observationally. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, we see those arguments in their most detailed and nuanced forms coming under increasing critical scrutiny. So I would actually say it's gone so far that linguistics has turned a corner. And a case could even be made that it's become the majority view that Chomsky is wrong. And one of the major reasons for this has to do with developments in what's called statistical learning. And what we're seeing is that using statistical information, that is keeping track of regularities in the stream of speech, is a very, very powerful tool for arriving at structure and organization that would be very difficult to identify if you reflected on that input in some rational or cognitive way. Chomsky was imagining that the learner was constructing rules through deliberation and reflection. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out that even the most sophisticated...
That clearly it's not possible. That doesn't work that way.
It's not possible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But once you start to think that learning is a dumb process, one that's very automatic and that's driven by statistical learning, you suddenly have a tool for explaining the achievement in early childhood that's more powerful than we ever appreciated. But saying that is not enough. And I think one of the really exciting front lines in linguistics these days is coming up with models, sometimes computer models, that can show the kind of achievement that we witness in young children with the same kinds of inputs. So basically you feed the speech that children hear to a simple computer system that has a sophisticated statistical learning algorithm, and you show that it arrives at the rules that kids do. It's early days for this stuff, and I think the most...
But sir, let me ask you this. So doesn't that mean, however, in some sense, that not exactly that Chomsky was wrong as much as that the emphasis was in the wrong place? That is, we still have to have some way, the ability to do, for instance, statistical learning, right? Clearly not every animal does. You cannot feed the same kind of information to a bunch of other animals and make them talk.
But it doesn't have anything to do with language, per se.
No, that's right.
So, like statistical learning.
Right, right. So the focus is, it doesn't have to do with language per se, but it still does have to do with the way in which the human brain works as opposed to the brain of other species.
Absolutely. Right. And I think we can't lose sight of that because it's important for understanding our achievement in the linguistic domain. So, I mean, to make this vivid, we've talked for years now about language centers of the brain. Mm-hmm. There's two most famous ones, Broca's area in the frontal cortex and Wernicke's in temporal cortex. Well, it turns out that these so-called language centers do lots and lots of other stuff. So we're suddenly in a position to approach language learning not by positing this special mechanism that's sort of there for language, but looking at how other mechanisms that exist in other creatures have changed in subtle ways that allow these extraordinary linguistic achievements. Mm-hmm. And one sort of example of that is it turns out that these pattern-recognizing machines do better if they start with a very limited capacity for statistical learning and incrementally increase. And there is fairly good evidence that this is exactly how human memory works. It starts out really small and gets better and better over time. And if you compare human memory growth to primate memory growth, basically they taper off well before we do.
Before, right.
So this capacity to incrementally grow, you can think of it very simply as mastering, say, pairs of words, to mastering triples of words, right, to mastering whole phrases. Right. And the incremental learning is extremely powerful for arriving at a syntax that allows for strings of meaningful signs, what we call words, that are indefinitely long. But if we never got to the ability to go from small patterns to larger patterns, we'd right. be stuck at basically the level of two words. And that's precisely what we see in efforts to train chimpanzees
right.
to speak.
Mm-hmm. So I want to note I know that Julia wants to make another point, but I want to note an irony here as far as Chomsky is concerned, because for all effective purposes, talking about a grammar module or a specific organ of the brain that is deals directly with language actually is a precursor of what evolutionary psychologists were saying. And Chomsky, as far as I can tell, is actually not particularly sympathetic to evolutionary psychology and to the whole idea of modules of the mind. So it's like it's a little ironic that his main theory actually presupposes that sort of very specialized organ that has been the staple of evolutionary psychological thinking.
Yeah, I've been struck by that irony too. I mean, I think there are interesting social or intellectual history of these movements that would be worth tracing out. But I do think Chomsky's attitudes towards evolution changed a bit. By the 2000s, he was looking at evolution in more positive terms. And he wrote a very important sort of seminal paper with Mark Hauser and Fitch, where they argued that there was a major evolutionary change that allowed for human language to become recursive. And that, he said, was the key to what we have and what non-human animals don't. But the particular claim is really problematic. It's problematic because recursion is actually found in lots of systems that have nothing to do with language. So the visual system has to recursively embed one structure in another. A recursive system is just a system whose symbolic representations can contain others and contain others in a mm-hmm. nested way. And vision does this all the time. You see a complex object like a tree, and then you can look at the branches and the twigs and the lines and the leaves and keep breaking it down. But moving the other way, there's at least one language that's been recently discovered and studied that has been argued to lack recursive structure. So the mm-hmm. claim that recursion is essential to language and exclusive to language can be challenged from both directions.
What would a language that doesn't have a recursive structure look like?
Well, we see it in chimp language. So when you try and train chimps to use simple systems, they can create a sentence with two or three words. But once they've mastered a two or three word sentence, they don't ever develop ways to embed that in a yet longer sentence. So I can say, put the hat on the table. But what about put the red hat on the table, or put the hat that you were wearing last night on the table, or put the red hat that you were wearing last night on the table on which the glass is situated? So those...
I don't know about you. Chimps say that to me all the time. Like,
right. So you basically... I mean, and of course, this is something we do expect to find in human languages, and we typically do. So the court is still out on this one Amazonian case. But I do think, given the existence of linguistic style communication in chimps that lacks this structure, the assumption that it's present in every language can't be taken for granted.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you about something on your website when you're describing your research interests. You say that you'd like to resuscitate core claims of British empiricism against the backdrop of contemporary philosophy of mind and cognitive science. And I was hoping you could elaborate on what you mean by British empiricism here, and I guess along the way, like how your approach to thinking about these things differs from what you see as the standard and contemporary philosophy of mind.
Great. Yeah, I mean, that's...
And we have abundant time, 10 minutes or so.
Empiricism, go!
First, thanks for visiting the website. I do think that we all have our intellectual heroes, and I like to think that everything I've done is kind of plagiarized from the British empiricists. So these were guys who really started to challenge the idea that the human mind was stocked with a rich set of innate principles, and started to trace out the origins of human knowledge to experience. And they went so far as to claim that human beings don't think using a language-like code, but instead think using something more like sensory imagery, that the medium of thought is a lot like the medium of sensory imagination. We visualize things in order to understand them. And they argue that we acquire understanding through observation. And this extends really to all domains. So I think within the tradition that preceded empiricism, rationalism, people thought everything from mathematics to theology was innately inscribed in the mind by the hand of God. And the empiricists have tried to look at how knowledge of mathematics, how beliefs in things like religion and also things like morality might have their origin in human activity and observation. So as an empiricist, I'm really interested in trying to go back to the cognitive turn when cognitive science was born under Chomsky's influence and say there was a moment there where rationalism really entered into the fabric of the sciences of the mind in a way that made it seem like we couldn't study the mind scientifically without supposing a lot of innate knowledge. And I think what we're seeing now is a huge body of research suggesting that the empiricists may have been right. So, for instance, there's a lot of work suggesting that mental imagery plays a huge role in human thought and understanding. We're seeing a lot of evidence that all kinds of aspects of human social life, and including our tendency to form religious systems, might have their basis in much simpler capacities. And we're seeing that systems like morality that were once thought to be universal are hugely varied across culture, and we can actually trace out the specific historical factors that lead to a given moral system and the specific pattern of learning, usually a kind of emotional conditioning, that leads a person to acquire a set of moral norms if they aren't innately specified.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the empiricists, because in preparing for this podcast, I actually reread a paper by Michael Gill that came out in 2000 on Hume's progressive view of human nature. And I was struck by this because, you know, I'm a fan of Hume, but I did not know that he actually had written about human nature in some sense. And basically, the gist of the article is that Hume was involved in a debate that was going on at the time in 18th century England about human nature, with people on two sides of the debate essentially assuming either way that there was a sort of a constant invariant human nature, either a good one or a bad one, you know, either selfish or cooperative, but it was invariant. And that Hume's idea was, on the other hand, that human nature is something that changes over time. Of course, he didn't use the term evolves, and at any rate, it didn't mean evolve biologically. It meant evolve culturally. But basically, his idea was, look, you know, you start out with certain things. The basic way, for instance, that we may approach in one of the debates was about justice and the fact that the people recognize that we need a system of justice. Hume's idea was that when initially the first time you sort of start thinking about this, it may be because it's because of selfish impulses. You realize that if there is no system of justice, then you're going to be in trouble one of these days. Somebody's going to do something bad to you. But eventually, these association of ideas, to use these terms, between justice is a good thing, that it does good for you, but it also does good for sort of society at large, translates into a change of attitude, into an incorporating the idea that in the long term that it's sort of a feeling, an emotion, that this is a good thing. That has changed the way you think about that particular topic. So this brings me to the last question I wanted to ask you. We've got abundant 3 or 4 minutes. From the outside, it seems to me that we still do not have a particularly compelling, comprehensive theory of human culture, especially if you exclude memetics, which I do.
You mean about why it evolves the way it does?
Yeah, well, by evolve, yes, but I don't mean biological evolution,
Yeah.
I mean why? Cultural evolution.
Yes.
So we don't have a particularly good theory of cultural evolution. People have tried. You know, memeticism, of course, is one attempt. Cavalli, Sforza, Feldman, and people at Stanford had tried in the 70s and 80s with their gene culture coevolution, which made some progress, but it's, I think, very limited, and I don't think it went very far. Is that the wrong impression that I have, or is there somebody out there that is actually working on a comprehensive theory of human culture, or are we still out there so describing things but without a comprehensive theory?
I think we don't have a comprehensive theory, but I also think we shouldn't expect one. I mean, the problem is there's not a single mechanism of cultural transmission. And, I mean, Hume is a great example of this, because Hume has this beautiful account of how we arrive at morality, which you just rehearsed very concisely. I mean, he says, we have a biological tendency to be nice to our near and dear. We basically are good to our friends, and we care for our loved ones and family. But this isn't enough to give us any moral regard for strangers, much less distant others, people in other cultures far away. But he talks about how through self-interest, we can come to realize that creating more large-scale cooperative enterprises like state-sized societies is very beneficial. So if we can just train ourselves to extend our love or sympathy or benevolence to strangers, we can all end up being better off. So that's it's almost a rational account of this cultural change, mm-hmm. from our biased preference for near and dear to our expanding umbrella that leads to large-scale societies. But there are lots of other stories about how we might see moral change. Some of them, so Nietzsche, who's a kind of interesting counterpoint to Hume, has a much more cynical view. He says morality is really about power, and people who are desirous of controlling more and more human beings can disseminate a system of values that incorporate a kind of norm that we should be obedient to authority, and that's a very different story. And I think at the end, what we'll get out of a theory of culture is not a general account, but an account of the human psychological capacities for learning, like which things make us emotional, which things do we imitate, which things attract our attention. And those together will be susceptible to all kinds of different influences, rational, powerful, and that set of influences can be used to then, in a kind of historical way that makes use of cognitive science, recount how any given cultural form came into being.
Just to clarify, Jesse, some of the basic tenets of most moral systems, like the you shouldn't kill people who are close to you and you should help people who are close to you, are you arguing that those are culturally determined, or...
Absolutely.
You are.
So I mean, we
don't have time to argue about this, but it seems like there's such a strong evolutionary argument for why that would be the case, that genes would... genes that made you want to help your children or your siblings would spread more than genes that didn't. Like,
I do think care for near and dear, care for your immediate family, maybe even people with whom you regularly fraternize, your friends, the people you come into regular contact with, that may have a biological basis. So it's really the claim of how this expands out. And you look at the human capacity for violence, I mean, just the mass scale killing that's been institutionalized, or the human capacity to exploit the misery of others. I mean, in any class society,
yeah, we're pretty good at that.
So it's really, it's not a claim that human beings don't have some natural capacity to be good to their near and dear. I think we do. But I think that to even call it a kernel or a core of morality is really misleading, since so much of morality deals with principles that have nothing to do with these natural form of empathy or sympathy, and have much more to do with very law-governed principles of distribution and power.
I thought of it as a kernel just because it's present in pretty much universally.
A final remark on that. I mean, I actually think that the problem with this focus on empathy is that it's so biased. So if we were to try and build a moral system just on our tendency to care for our near and dear, we would end up with a very bad system, because it's extremely hard to extend that to others. So I think Hume had an overly optimistic view insofar as he thought that benevolence was something that could just spread to all people everywhere, when in fact the human capacity for niceness is more limited than that.
I don't know if I'm allowed to end this section of the podcast with you criticizing Massimo's favorite philosopher, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Well, you just said that he's an empiricist. That's good enough.
All right. We're going to wrap up this section of the podcast then and move on to the Rationally Speaking Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time we ask our guest, Jesse Prince, for his suggestion. Jesse?
Well, as a deep fan of cinema, I think that we can find a lot of things that are related to our theme, which is human nature and the cultural influences on human behavior in the cinematic world. In fact, cinema is a little bit like travel. You can watch a film and it will take you to another place. And we can even do a little bit of anthropology by watching films from other times and places and learning a bit about the values that inhere in other cultures. And of the many, many films that one could use to illustrate this point, I'm going to pick one that happens to be of special interest to me, which is called White God and Black Devil. Oh. And this is a film by a very important Brazilian director who's not appreciated in the United States, named Glauber Rocha. And Rocha was a kind of prodigy director who died fairly young at 42, but made a series of extremely important films that revolutionized film in Brazil. He thought that Brazil needed its own cinema, needed a style that was distinctively Brazilian, that called on European traditions, but also had marks of the local culture. And White God, Black Devil is a film that exactly exemplifies this ambition. It has a kind of chorus element, which harks back to Greek theater. It has certain framings of shots which look like Sergei Eisenstein from the Russian silent tradition. It borrows from various French and German traditions as well, but it also is about the Brazilian experience. The setting is the very arid regions within the northeast of Brazil that are far from the coast, where people lived and continue to live in considerable poverty. And the film opens with a poor herder who is in a conflict with his boss because his boss is trying to swindle him, and that results in a violent altercation and the boss is killed. So suddenly this herder has to go on the run, and he and his partner basically go on a tour of this region of Brazil, and they first encounter a charismatic leader of a religious cult, a figure who claims to be a saint, who's leading a very large mass of followers. The religious leader has come into conflict with the Catholic Church, so the organized religion, which is reflective of the more established and European connected religious traditions, as opposed to a kind of blend of African and Christian religion, which is manifest in the cult. And of course, the government has an interest in these issues as well, because they don't like the idea of a charismatic leader leading the masses in ways that might have political ramifications. So suddenly this character is thrown at the heart of a conflict that includes people from very different backgrounds, ethnically, religiously, and all of these different aspects of Brazilian culture, from the established government and the established church to these more popular religious movements that have a kind of mystical dimension, are brought into the same frame. And the film deals with politics of corruption, politics of violence, politics of poverty, but does so in a way that's constantly inventive with respect to cinematic style, and never so editorial that the viewer isn't left having to make some decisions for herself about this particular situation.
Thanks, Jesse. I should also mention to our listeners that if you go to Jesse's website, which we can link to underneath the link to this podcast, you can see a little bit of his writing on the intersection between art and philosophy, or between cinema and philosophy. There's an essay which I skimmed and can recommend called "When Is Film Art?" which is under his philosophy section. So check it out.
Thanks, Julia.
It was really great having you as a guest, Jesse. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I love the cast.
Us too. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.